When first, or by what prosaic chance, Tamar got access to the friend of God and became his devotee, no one precisely knows. Perhaps it happened before Joseph's death, and perhaps it was by Jacob's arrangement that she was taken into the tribe and given for wife to young Judah's eldest. But the relation between her and the old man deepened and became intimacy only after the frightful blow had fallen, and after Jacob's slow and unwilling recovery. Only when his bereaved heart was unconsciously reaching for new emotional outlets, then only did he become aware of Tamar, and drew her to himself because of her admiration for him. By that time, the 11, his sons, were almost all married, the older ones long since, the younger more recently, and had children from their wives. Even Benoni Benjamin, the little son of death, had come on in his turn. Scarcely had he outgrown his urchinhood, become a youth, and then reached man's estate, 7 years perhaps after the loss of his brother, when Jacob found and wooed for him first Mahalia, daughter of a certain Aram, of whom it was said that he was a grandson of Terah, and so, somehow or other, descended from Abraham or from one of his brothers, and then the maid Arbeth, daughter of a man named Simron, called quite explicitly a son of Abram, which might mean that he came of that stock by some concubine. As for the pedigree of Jacob's daughters-in-law, the record has been both toned down and touched up, and an effort made to show the blood kinship of the priestly stock, although the case had not a leg to stand on and was not even consistently attempted. Levi's and Issachar's wives were held to be the granddaughters of Eber. Perhaps they were. Even so, they might have come from Asur or Elam. Gad and the glib Naphtali had followed their father's example and taken wives from Haran and Mesopotamia. But that these wives were actually great-granddaughters of Nahor, Abraham's uncle, they did not themselves assert. It was asserted of them. Asher, the sweet tooth, took a nut-brown maid from the seed of Ishmael. Well, at least that was a relation, if a dubious one. Zebulun, of whom one might have expected a Phoenician marriage, actually went in unto a Midianite. This was correct only in so far as Midian was a son of Keturah, Abram's second wife. But had not big Reuben already gone and incontinently married a Canaanite woman? So too had Judah, as we know, and so Simeon, for his Buna had been stolen from Shechem. As for Dan, Bilhah's son, whom they called Snake and Adder, his wife was well known to be a Moabitess, descended from that Moab whom Lot's eldest daughter had borne to her own father, and to herself her own brother. Not particularly wholesome, that, nor had it anything to do with blood kinship, since Lot had not been Abram's brother, but only a proselyte. From Adam, of course, he too descended, and equally, of course, from Shem, since he came from the land of the two rivers. Blood kinship is always possible to demonstrate, if one takes in enough of the picture. So all the sons brought their wives to their father's house, as we are told. In other words, the place of the tribe in the grove of Mamre near Kirjath Arba and the burying ground around Jacob's house of Hare grew larger as the days went on, and descendants multiplied according to the promise round Jacob's knees, when the majestic graybeard permitted it, and in his goodness he sometimes did, and fondled his grandchildren. Particularly Benjamin's he fondled, for Turturah, a stocky little fellow who still had his trustful gray eyes and heavy metallic helmet of hair, also a rather muddy complexion, had become father to 5 sons in quick succession, born to him by his Aramaic wife, as well as other little ones in between, born of the daughter of Simron. The grandchildren of Rachel were always Jacob's favorites. But despite their presence and Benoni's paternal dignity, Jacob still treated his youngest like a child, kept him in leading strings as though he were not grown up, and gave him very small freedom, lest mischance befall him. Scarcely to go into the town, to Hebron, scarcely to the fields, to say nothing of making a trip across country, would he permit his one remaining pledge of Rachel's love, though he was far from loving Benoni as he had loved Joseph, and there was no actual reason on his account to fear the jealousy of the higher power. Still, since the lovely one had fallen to the tooth of the swine, Benoni had become the only treasure of Jacob's care and concern. Wherefore he did not let him out of his sight, and would pass no hour without knowing where Benjamin was and what he was doing. Such supervision could not but be painful to Benjamin, and wounding to his dignity as husband and father. Yet he bore with it, though it depressed him, and presented himself before his father several times a day, in obedience to Jacob's whim. For if he did not, Jacob came himself on his long staff, halting from his hip, to see after him. Although, as Benjamin well knew, and as was plain enough from the old man's capricious behavior, Jacob's feelings were actually very divided, being a queer mixture of hidden grudge and sense of property. For at bottom, he never ceased to see in Benoni the matricide and the instrument God had used to take Rachel from him. One important advantage, certainly, besides that of being the youngest born, Benoni had over all the living brothers. And for Jacob's dreamily associational mentality, it made one more reason to keep his youngest always at home. For Benjamin had been at home when Joseph got lost in the world. And as we know Jacob, this equivalence between being at home and being innocent, having quite definitely no share in a crime committed from home, was symbolically well lodged in his mind. Thus Benjamin had always to be on hand as the sign and the permanent token of his guiltlessness, and of the fact that he alone, the youngest, did not lie under the abiding, ever silently gnawing suspicion which, both rightly and wrongly, Jacob cherished, and which the others knew that he cherished. It was the suspicion that the boar which had rent Joseph had been a beast with 10 heads. And Benjamin had to be at home in token that the beast had quite definitely not had 11. But perhaps not even 10 heads. God only knew, and he might keep it to himself. Indeed, as the days and years went on, the question lost importance. It did so above all because Jacob, since he had stopped bickering with God, had gradually arrived at the view that it was not God who had by main strength laid upon him the sacrifice of Isaac, but that he himself had done it of his own free will. As long as the first agony lasted, such an idea had been far from him. He had only thought of himself as cruelly misused. But as the pain faded, habit set in, death made his advantage good, namely that Joseph was safe in his bosom and care, for ever and ever 17 years old, then this soft, pathetic soul had seriously begun to conceive itself capable of Abraham's deed of sacrifice. To the honor of God this fancy was born, and to Jacob's own. God had not monstrously and craftily robbed him of his dearest. He had but taken what, consciously and in heroic spirit, had been offered, the dearest thing that Jacob owned. Believe it or not, Jacob pretended to himself, and bore himself witness for the sake of his pride, that in the hour when he let Joseph set out on the journey to Shechem, he had committed the Isaac sacrifice, and freely, out of love of God, had surrendered to him the being he too dearly loved. Jacob did not believe this all the time. Sometimes he confessed to himself with contrition and fresh-flowing tears that he would never have been capable, for the love of God, of tearing the beloved from his heart. But the yearning to believe it sometimes won the day, and when it did, the question who had mangled Joseph became relatively unimportant. The suspicion, certainly it was nonetheless there. It gnawed, but more gently and not at every hour. Sometimes in later years it slumbered and slept. The brothers had pictured living under suspicion, under half-wrongful suspicion, as being worse than in fact it proved to be. The father was on good terms with the sons, that is clear. He spoke with them and broke bread with them. He shared their business, their household sorrows and joys. He looked in their faces, and only once in a while, only at intervals already quite far apart, did the gleam come into his old eyes, or suspicion and hypocrisy cloud his old gaze, before which they, breaking off in their words, had to cast down their eyes. But how much did that mean? A man casts down his eyes, even if he knows no more than that another suspects him. It does not inevitably mean he is guilty. A scrupulous innocence and pity for the man sick of mistrust may equally so express itself. And so at last, a man even gets sick of his suspicions. In the end, he lets them rest. Especially if confirmation, without reference to past events, can change nothing of the future, or the promise, or anything that is to be. The brothers might be the ten-headed Cain, they might be fratricides, but after all, they were what they were, Jacob's sons. They were the given conditions that must be reckoned with. They were Israel. For Jacob had deliberately taken to using the name he had wrested at Jabbok, after which he halted upon his thigh, not only for his own person, but with a broader and larger meaning. Why not? Since it was his name, hardly won, and not until the dawn, he might deal with it as he would. Israel. Thus should not only he personally be called, but all that belonged to him, the man of the blessing, from the nearest to the latest never-last member in all the branchings and collateral branchings, the kin, the stock, the folk, whose numbers should be like the stars and the sands by the sea. The children sometimes permitted to play at Jacob's knee, they were Israel. Collectively he called them so, and even fell back on it gratefully when he could not keep all their names in mind. It was particularly the names of the children of the Ishmaelite, and definitely Canaanite women, that escaped him. But Yisrael, these women were too, including the Moabitess and the slave woman from Shechem. And Yisrael, in the first line and above all, were their husbands, the 11, deprived of their full zodiacal number by early evident and prolonged fraternal strife and by heroic sacrifice, yet still a goodly rank. Jacob's sons, progenitors of countless generations, to whom they in their turn would bequeath their name, mighty men before the Lord, whatever each single one might be like inside, and whatever each one had in his mind when he cast down his eyes. What did it all matter, when through thick and thin they always remained Yisrael? For Jacob knew, long before it stood written, and it only stands written because he knew it, that Yisrael, even when it had sinned, always remained Israel. But in Israel there was always one head on whom the blessing rested before the others, as Jacob had been before Esau, and Joseph was dead. Upon one rested the promise, or would rest when Jacob conferred the blessing. From him the salvation should come, for which the father long sought a name, and had found one for the present, which no one knew save only the young female who sat at Jacob's feet. Who was the chosen one among the brothers, from whom it should come? Who was the man of the blessing, now that the choice no longer went by love, for the love was dead? Not Reuben, the eldest, who had shot away like the unstable waterfall and had played the hippopotamus. Not Simeon or Levi. They were personally nothing but unlicked cubs, and had some unforgettable items against them on their score, for they had behaved like heathen savages at Shechem, and like satyrs in Hamor city. This three were accursed, insofar as Israel can be accursed. They fell away, and so it had to be the fourth who came next after them, Judah. He it was.